Mr. De La Forest, could you escort your troop outside, please?
It stopped, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We're going to get started even though we don't have a quorum, because we're running up against session schedule and other schedules that are getting mixed in here, so we'll try and do our best. And whenever you are ready, sir, identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Sure, 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 sure.
I'm assuming you guys are with the military of some sort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Our principal briefer today, Colonel Bruce Jensen, is to my left. We do actually have handouts for the committee. We'll get those flipping around here. And we also have Colonel Scott St. Sauber, and he is our Camp Ripley commander. He has some relevant information with regard to activities at Camp Ripley, and should there be any questions from the committee, we wanted to have him here. And we're hopeful that we can make the technology work, but we're prepared to brief if we can. That looks like it's
weird. There you go.
All right.
Say, Don, could you state your last name, because
yes,
I didn't catch it.
Once again, sir, I'm Don Kerr, K-E-R-R, and I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs.
Thanks.
And I'm going to turn it over to Colonel Bruce Jensen, and if Scott's going to run the drive here, I'll do some
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Colonel Bruce Jensen. I'm the Facilities Management Officer for the Army National Guard.
Thank you.
We've got the slides up. The purpose of this brief is to give you an overview of the Department of Military Affairs capital budget request for this year. Next slide, please. Agenda, just a listing of the things that we'd like to go through. We'll talk a little bit about our footprint, and we'll get into more details on the specific request, and then also follow it up with the educational complex request, which is a larger portion of the request. First slide here is just to give you an idea of the footprint of the facilities that we are maintaining, the asset preservation dollars that we receive on an annual or a biannual basis goes to support most of these facilities. There's 63 training community center or armories located across the state. We've got approximately $4.6 million our square feet of building that we support with that budget, along with the federal matching dollars we receive. This outlines briefly what our strategy is as far as asset preservation or maintenance of our facilities. Obviously, we're trying to get more in a proactive mode to replacing systems before they fail. And in order to do that, we looked at all our facilities over the course of 25 years, and really what we try to accomplish is 5 to 6 major renovations and repairs of our facilities during a biennium, and you'll see that theme as we look at subsequent slides. Along with that, there are health safety issues, American Disabilities Act, codes that we require when we go in and maintain and renovate our facilities. The last point on there ties into the educational complex. Camp Ripley is the center for training for the Army National Guard in Minnesota, but it also provides resources and a place for a number of interagency partners that we have, be it Highway Patrol, DOT, Department of Natural Resources. Those types of customers, as they come to Camp Ripley, also use the facilities on poles. Slide. This slide gives you an idea of the major batch projects, that we call it. When I refer to the term batch, we'll go in and do major building systems that are due to be repaired, be it windows, roofs, ventilation systems. So it's a major undertaking for the facility, and typically it will close that building down for up to a year, and we'll relocate the soldiers that use that facility to some other location. So it's a major type undertaking. You can see over the last 3 biennium, the projects that we've done, FY12 and 13, those are the 5 that we're calculating into our request for for this year's request. As I mentioned, the asset preservation is $5.5 million. That addresses major building components and repairs. You can see a listing there. Also under that, we'll do life safety. If there's asbestos abatement that's required, comes out of that account. Any ADA compliance issues are paid for out of that amount of money. So really everything that we need to do to the building is comes out of this account. And with the asset preservation, it's normally coupled with 50% federal match that I receive on an annual basis. So it's a 50-50 split for the armories when we go in and do these projects. Next slide. This slide gives you an idea of, I mentioned the five batch projects, and that keeps us in line with what our strategy is for capital improvements. And you can see the estimated costs and also the federal share that's calculated into those. These are not out to design yet. What we've done is went around and did a thorough inventory, and what we do is compare that to a like-type square footage cost, and that's where the dollars came, based on historical costs that we experience on similar batches. The second part of our request is the $19.5 million for the Camp Ripley Educational Complex. Three major components to the request. What we're looking at is additional classroom space, as well as a billeting or a lodging component to that, and that would house 40 personnel, and then also a centralized dining facility for the for Camp Ripley. Next slide. This gives you a little bit more overview of what actually it is. The three items together are a little over 49,000 square foot addition, and this would accommodate an additional classroom size for 200 people, 40 students as far as lodging, and then also the dining facility would be built towards a 400 person capacity. Right now the existing capacity is 120, so you start feeding a large number of people. You start at 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, and you're finally finished with the afternoon meal probably at 1:30 or so. So trying to enlarge that capability so we can get soldiers and other users in and out of the facility and back to their training. This is just an overview. This addition would actually be attached onto the current existing education center where we've got a number of classrooms. That's essentially the major component to the existing our education center.
Colonel, just sure. Pause for a second. We now have a quorum. Representative Banyan would move the minutes of the last meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Colonel, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next slide. The $19.5 million is request would fund 100% of the construction costs, and I know that there's been questions about that. If you go to the next slide, please. Why there's no federal match. Through the normal process on the federal budget side, if we were trying to obtain this, we'd be looking at probably 2018 or 19 at the earliest to follow through the normal federal process to get the funding to do this. And we have the requirement now, and because of the connection with a number of our standard interagency partners, we're asking for this to be bonded through the state bonding process. As you can see, the final bullet, or the second to the last bullet down there, we've already received a large portion of federal dollars scheduled for 2017. That's a $63 million project. So any other items that we put in would actually compete with ourselves in many cases. And as I said before, the earliest we would be looking at trying to get this through the federal process would be probably 2018 at the earliest. The other major point on that is even though it would be constructed with state dollars, because it would be designed to federal criteria, the long-term capital sustainment would be borne by the federal government through my normal federal operating budget. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, subject to your questions, that's the conclusion of my brief. There are a number of backup slides that provide additional information in your packets.
for the committee's information, Colonel, with regard to, do I say Fort Ripley or Camp Ripley?
Mr. Chairman, Camp Ripley.
Okay. Why do we always say Fort Ripley?
Typically a fort is
I know what a fort is, but why do we say that? Anyway, could you explain to the committee the with all your facilities, are they operated by the federal government, operated by state government, or is it a share kind of a basis? And who owns the property?
With the exception, Mr. Chairman, with the exception of Arden Hills, all of our facilities are state-owned property. So depending on the purpose of the facility, it's supported many times. Our armories are probably the most common one everybody's familiar with. Those are supported 50% federal and 50% state. And that money comes through a cooperative agreement. So the vast majority of what work that we do on our facilities is done through state contracting procedures. Very little is done through federal. So most of our employees are state employees that work on the facilities, and they're managed by the state of Minnesota through the Department of Military Affairs.
Since you said employees, Colonel, I'm going to ask you, are you paid every Friday by the state or by the federal government?
I'm a federal employee. Okay. Every 2 weeks.
Good. Go ahead, continue.
Or you're done.
Yes, sir.
I don't see any questions,
Mr. Chairman.
I don't see any questions. You did a good job, obviously.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now the excuse me, the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Yes. Federal.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McKelney from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the legislative director, and I apologize for the delay. Apparently our state thumb drives don't operate with federal computers. I'm here today with Deputy Commissioner Pam Burrows, who will be giving you an overview on our capital investment request. And so at this point in time, I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Burrows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Pam Burrows, Interim Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare. And I would like to start out by giving you a little bit of an overview about the Minneapolis campus. I think it's in your handouts. To just let you know where our residents reside on that campus and give you a little bit of background. As you look at the first current configuration, that slide, Building 6 is currently housing 91 residents, and that was a women's and orphans, originally a women's and orphans building built in 1905. And just to give you a little background, Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Veterans Home is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. So we're happy with that. Building 9 is the new building, 100-bed skilled nursing facility that is currently under construction. If you recall, I think in 2008, that building, old Building 9, was vacated due to structural deterioration, and that housed our domiciliary population. And at that time, in Building 17, we had an empty 50-bed unit, and we moved those residents onto that empty 50-bed unit, and they've been there since that time. And then the decision was made to build a 100-bed skilled nursing home, single bed neighborhood type concept. And currently we are, I think in the 2010 session, Building 17, the north half of Building 17 and Building 16 were funded for renovation, and the goal was to tear down the north half of that of Building 17 and build another 100-bed scaled nursing facility and renovate Building 16 for the 50-bed domiciliary unit. Currently, we are looking, requesting bonding to complete that project, to complete Building 17, which also includes Building 15 and 18. And if you look at the next slide, that would show the future configuration of all three of those buildings. And they would each be 100 beds skilled, so a total of 300 beds skilled in new construction. And then the Building 6 would then go down to the 341. Currently, we're licensed for 341 skilled beds and 50 domiciliary beds. And since probably about 2007, we have been operating 291 skilled beds and 50. So the goal then, when all of this construction is done, would be to go back up to the 341 skilled and the 50 domiciliary. And that would pretty much, I think, complete the major portion of big construction on that campus. Currently, we are asking for $25.42 million to complete that part of the project. We know that the we're on the deferred priority one list for federal authorization of a little over 17.5 million. It's conditionally approved. We would need to get approval this year to get those funds. We'd need to submit that by August 15th. If we don't, we would have to take that off the conditionally approved and go back into the pool of nationally states vying for the state home grants funding program. And currently on their priority one list of projects, they have a little over $315 million of requests at priority one, and they were up to $100 million, and they're back down to about $85 million each year. So it's fairly critical from our moving forward point of view that we would be able to demonstrate to them that we had the state funds. And this phase would complete the renovation of Building 17. It would demolish the south half of that building and as I said, replace it with a new 100-bed skilled nursing facility. One of the things, conditions in the past that the legislature has asked us to do is look at Medicare, Medicaid certification for additional funding. And as we did that, as we did our study and looked at achieving that certification, we would not have been able to do that with our current buildings, because we would not have been able to get the waiver from the Department of Health on Building 17. So, and these new buildings will obviously meet CMS certification standards for the buildings. This $25.42 million also includes a tunnel, which would allow for the HVAC and utilities distribution, and probably more importantly, preserve the integrity of a home light neighborhood setting for all of these new buildings. It'd be similar to kind of the tunnels here at the Capitol. It would connect 6, 9, and 17, and so the movement of all the supplies and support services would be through the tunnels instead of through the main part of the homes that are being built. It also includes the establishment of a new network and server room to replace the aging undercapacity LEC telecom closet that is currently serving the Minneapolis Veterans Home. And again, the next page would look at, gives you an idea of what the campus would look like once everything is completed. The second priority in our bonding request is to renovate Building 13, which is the centralized into a centralized pharmacy. Currently, we operate a pharmacy in the south lower half of Building 17. Our goal is to centralize all of our pharmacy operations. I think some of you may be aware, and some not, that as part of our cost of care, we provide pharmaceuticals to our residents in all of our veterans' homes. And we are able to obtain our pharmaceuticals through VA contracting. And one of the things that we have started to do again to look at generating some additional revenue to offset some of our increasing inflationary expenses and the cost of pharmaceuticals is we're billing for Medicare D and third-party reimbursement. And our goal is to have provide the centralized pharmacy for all five of our homes and hopefully be able to do that through remote dispensing. Currently Building 13, it's on the historical register, and it's been sitting empty as probably just a storage area for a number of years. And so the cost would be to renovate the interior and remodel the interior to house the centralized pharmacy. And we have put this forward for matching funds for up to 65%. So it's on the state home construction grant list, and we'll have to move up there on their priority list to be able to get that. And the third priority would be $3 million, which would be department-wide asset preservation. As our buildings age, we want to be able to maintain them so that they don't get so bad. So it's looking at things like resident room door replacements, nurse call replacement, boilers and burner parts replacement, storage building repairs, exterior envelope and replacement of windows and doors. Those types of activities. So we have a total request for these three priorities of $29.786 million. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Carlson.
You knew I might have a question.
You raised your hand up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I've got a question looking at the request for the pharmacy building, and how many square feet is that? I'm thinking of the 1.36 million, and from the charts and so on, it's just a little bit difficult to see what size building and so on we're remodeling, or maybe another way of putting it is what is the cost per square foot, being that we're retaining a current building and simply gutting it according to the description here and redoing the inside.
Ms. Barrows.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize. I do not know the answer, but we can get that for you.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, that would be fine if you could.
We will get that.
And that may be a very reasonable number. It's just hard to tell what the facility looks like from the chart here. The other question I had, being that you brought up pharmacy, if you're a, let's say you're a disabled American vet, but not a resident of the home, can you access the pharmacy there? I know you can out at Fort Snelling, but...
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Barrows.
Representative, at this time, no. That that would be just for our internal operation, and you would have to go through the federal, through the Minneapolis VA or one of those.
Yeah, I am familiar with that. My father's deceased, and he was a disabled vet, and he used to get his... pharmaceuticals out at what I call Fort Snelling, or the other question I had, the building 14, that is the steam plant, and I'm just, when you say you're going to be done, have we redone the steam plant at some point? Is that current state of the art?
Ms. Burrows.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that's the steam plant, the way it looks there. And when I've been out at the facility with former Chair Houseman, we did a tour, and I remember the building there, and it looks like it's quite old. And when you mentioned that the campus is now 125 years old, I'm just curious whether that's state-of-the-art facility or not.
Ms. Barrows.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, you're probably out of my knowledge base, but... From what I do, little I do know about that part of the campus and construction, that's high pressure steam plant, and I think that operationally it's working quite well. I know as they looked at building 9 and these other buildings, they evaluated that whole system, and so. From my knowledge, I think that's not an issue at this point, but we can certainly clarify that and get back to you.
Well, that's fine. If it's not on your horizon, Mr. Chairman, then I assume it must be okay. One of the reasons I asked that question was some of our older campuses in higher education, that's been an issue periodically. Not too many years ago, for example, Winona State, which is one of our older campuses, that was an issue down there. They needed to modernize the facilities, and it's surfaced at others. And I was just looking at and remembering the age of the exterior of it, at any rate. Thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and ma'am. Just kind of following up on Representative Carlson's question, why couldn't any other veteran come and utilize the pharmacy benefits of the pharmacy? Is it a staffing issue? It is a federal military affairs issue, or what is the reason?
Ms. Burrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be the federal government's rules and regulations that would preclude that from happening. I don't know if we would even be allowed to have a sharing agreement to be able to do that, but basically the federal government, the VA has about 4 different ways that we can provide medications, pharmaceuticals to our residents, and the in-house pharmacy is one of them, but it's just strictly for our residents. But they would govern what we could do.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, we can ask our federal legislators to change law, because, Mr. Chair, my father was a disabled veteran, too, and we had to sometimes drive all the way down to Superior, which was, 75 miles away and an hour and a half. So, if the state's putting in money for the building, we should try to help out our veterans. So I was just hoping maybe we could do something on that order.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good that I see that we're going in order of height today with Carlson and Kavina and then Ward, I guess.
Representative Ward, yeah. Representative Ward, you're right. Would you hold on a second? Representative Clark, did you want to?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, just, you know, when we have this many veterans, current and past veterans, and I look at the generals and the colonel and Mr. McElhenry and all of the veterans, you know, it's just, I think, appropriate that we just all say thank you for your service to our current and past veterans. So I just wanted to say that to start with. And I also apologize for not being here on time. I had some, you know, we get these things down here called constituents, and they take up some of our time, and so I was appreciative of the notice to come and get me. So, but I did want to go on record, Mr. Chair, and you and I visited Camp Ripley for the education complex addition, and we toured that, and you know, I want to go on record as supporting that significantly, and mm-hmm. and saying what a great asset that would be, and then General Nash, we talked about that as well out in the breakfast that you had, and the assets that Camp Ripley provides for our area, not just, you know, that camp right there, but our whole area, 5-county, 7-county area there. So I just wanted to be on record to make sure that, you know, that this legislator strongly supports that bonding request. Mr. McElhenry, you and I have been on the phone a lot lately, and I about a number of different venues or questions or whatever. I wanted to just point out, and you know, you folks do a great job taking care of. My dad was a World War II vet too, a Navy guy, and you do a lot of good stuff for a lot of people, especially our veterans and veterans of the past. So I am appreciative of the veterans' nursing homes and all the services that you provide. You know, I've been trying to get a veterans' nursing home in Brainerd since I've been down here and prior to that. And I'm going to speak a little bit. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but that sleeping giant is here again. And about the discussion we had yesterday with MSOP and St. Peter about, you know, we have some buildings in our area, and Mr. McElhenry, you and I talked about the feds won't allow for that, and I get all that and everything else. But I did want to point this out, that, you know, Bemidji, and bless them up there for what they're trying to do to put a veterans nursing home up there. It is my belief that the next veterans home in our state is probably going to be our last federal veterans nursing home, in my opinion, just looking at the statistical information and things as such. And I wanted to point out that in this discussion, and I'm glad General Shalto is here, Commissioner Shalto, that as that, you know, those people up there in Bemidji are doing a great job, you know, making their case. The Department of Veterans Affairs recently did a survey about where the next veteran home, you know, would be likely to go based on a lot of information. And it came out, the survey came out as a priority of Little Falls, Brainerd, Crosby, and then others were underneath that and down the list significantly. And while I appreciate and respect all folks that are trying to move to help serve our veterans current and past, you know, I just have to advocate for, you know, that what you, the Department of Veterans Affairs, said was the geographical area to cover a huge amount of veterans that aren't being served, that have to go to Superior, Wisconsin, so to speak, or wherever to get the services provided. And that was one of the criteria that the survey from the Veterans Affairs Department used in order to select those priority list places, geographical places of Little Falls, Brainerd, Crosby, etc. And so as we move forward with veterans nursing homes, and you know, I would ask and go on record saying that survey be referenced as, you know, your own piece of information, and I thank you for allowing me to dialogue with that. And thank you again for all you do for veterans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, and I think I share some of the sentiments just now with my colleague here, John Ward. My dad just, we lost our dads about the same time, and my dad was 95 and spent his last 4 months in the Sioux Falls Veterans Home because the one in Laverne was full. there was no place there. Which is where he lives. But anyway, And I had found that it was really great service. But I have to say that I have constituents who've worked out at this home, and I know we've had some troubles. And so, Mr. Chair, I know this is a committee dealing with bonding, but I want to know what's going on inside the buildings and a little bit more, and how some of the things that needed to happen to improve the quality of care. Because I have another, I guess my father, outlaw, since we're not legal, can call my in-law but my outlaw, is probably headed your way, just as of a couple days ago. And I want to know what you can tell me. This is a person who has Parkinson's and needs to do some things that people with Parkinson's need to do in terms of walking around and stuff, people with Alzheimer's. And in these facilities that you have here, I don't know if you're able to tell me, but I'm just wondering, we have, you know, whole groups of veterans who are quite elderly, Second World War veterans, and need some certain things. Then we have all these young people coming back from the current wars, and they need some different kinds of things. And in terms of the building and the investing we're doing here, those are the two questions. What's going on with the care? Are we improved? And secondly, what special things in terms of these buildings might be directed towards either of what seems kind of too distinctly grouped? I mean, I'm not saying there's not people in between. There's the whole Vietnam group too, and, you know, which is another part of my family. But I just want to know what you can tell me about those two questions.
Ms. Burroughs, if you can do that inside of 90 seconds, that's awesome. If you can, if you could get the information and get it to Representative Clark. With all due respect, Representative Clark, if I go there, then whenever we bring up Minsky Project, someone might want to know how many kids are in the classroom or what the professor is like. And this committee just deals with spending the money. But if she can do it in 90 seconds, I'll let her go. Ms. Burroughs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think I can do it in 90 seconds, but I'll be happy to give her really positive news on both counts. And I think I can reassure her in both arenas. So we've got plans on the horizon, and the care is wonderful.
And since we are Representative Clark and Representative Ward, since we're talking about our fathers, my father passed away at the Minneapolis Vets Home. And back in the late 50s, early 60s, I sold candy bars out of school to the vets. And let me tell you, if you wanted to sell candy bars and bring $20 to school in 2 days, you went to the Minneapolis Vets. They bought as many as you had on you. Representative Carlson.
I was just going to ask, how close was your home, because I know you grew up in South Minneapolis, to the Veterans Home, because you must have been in that general
about
area.
About 7 blocks.
Okay. So I thought I remembered you know that area quite well, and I grew up bicycle distance.
Right, right. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I assume that we can get off on this tangent because you're talking about spending money or making it.
Yeah, I know. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the points that Representative Ward was making, and we had an opportunity earlier today to have a more extended conversation about this. And, you know, when you look at the map, there is a pretty big void in northern Minnesota. And what we hear more and more is this desire to be close to your community, close to your family. And the piece of information that I would like is how much have we spent in the last decade on the Minneapolis campus? When I saw this year's request and added this amount up and realized we were approaching $27 million for that campus, when I knew we had done significant amounts in recent years, and I knew that the desire is often there to be closer to home, I wonder, and I get impatient, when we will make this change about decentralizing. This is a big, expensive, historic campus, and so I know it's expensive, but when I look at that $25 million, I think to myself, I suspect you could probably build two pretty good homes up there for $25 million. and so it's that impatience about starting to do things in another way. You know, is this an old model, and when do we push to move to a different model when we're spending this kind of money? Just for the record and to sort of underscore what Representative Ward was saying.
Any other? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, I can't resist. Please, the map you're talking about, would you give me some clarification on that? Is that the second page?
It's the cover.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. And then if I could, and I don't mean this in a bad way, please. Northern Minnesota, your definition is? Okay. Thank you.
Anything north of Anoka.
Okay. Representative Hausman and Representative Fabian, and for Representative Ward, too. I know that Representative Ward and Purcell are going to argue whether this should be in Bemidji and Brainerd, and I'm here to help. I think I'll put it in Walker. Moving on.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rokovita.
Mr. Chair, but Representative Hausman, you bring up a legitimate question, and what is the distribution of veterans in the state, like metro versus rural, northwest, northeast, whatever? And is it somewhat commensurate, these nursing homes and beds, with that distribution, or is it just because, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul are the center of the universe, that everything gets to Minneapolis and St. Paul? Is it somewhat fair? I mean, are 30% of the veterans in rural Minnesota are whatever?
Ms. Burroughs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the distribution. I think it's in that study that we did in 2009. I think in the past, the location of veterans' homes was not based on distribution of where the veterans were. I think it was based on how you got the homes.
And so this plan, does it make it more fair?
Ms. Burroughs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would hope so. I was part of that that group that sat on that planning, and we had an outside planner working with us, and we used our best judgment based on experiences that we have running nursing homes. And thank you for, since I had Laverne for 14 years as the administrator, thank you for that.
Very good reputation.
And so the experiences that we had running nursing homes and working with the VA, because the VA is such a huge partner in what we do and what we can provide. So, and looking at the types of needs that we had in mental health care, mental health support, the different types of support systems that we need. So we, it was subjective. The criteria that we developed was subjective based on our experiences. And we put that into the plan, and that's how we came up with the communities that would meet that minimum need at least. And then the final ranking, because we were requested to do it in rank order, was based on kind of a combination of location to a VA or a CBOC to do that final ranking. But all 17 of those homes met the basic criteria of what we would need to have in a surrounding support area to provide good service in a veterans nursing home.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. It's an interesting comment when you mention the VA, because it's very, the VA hospital is very, very close there. There's also a VA hospital in St. Cloud. So I don't know, do we have a home in the St. Cloud area in close proximity to that VA? And maybe the services at the VA are different. I just know that it's very comprehensive on the Twin Cities, or the city of Minneapolis, one that's basically almost on Fort Snelling.
Ms. Burroughs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have a veterans nursing home in the St. Cloud area. I think there are certain criteria that you can't be, I think if I recall, 100 miles from another veterans home, there has to be some distances. So the locations were based on some of that criteria also that the federal government had for where we could locate homes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rukmina.
Chair, you know, I just want to say something for the members at the table and maybe people in the audience. I found out by mistake when my mother was in the nursing home for 3 years that and nobody ever told us, and I don't know if this information is out there, that my mother qualified for getting money in the nursing home because my father was a World War II veteran, and I think any veteran's widow. And so it was a pretty significant amount of money, but no one at the nursing home ever told us. Nobody at social services ever told us. And I think there are a lot of families out there that could use that money. So keep that in mind, members, and maybe Veterans Affairs, Minnesota Military Affairs or Veterans Affairs should get that word out because nobody ever told us. And it was a good chunk of money.
Representative Fabian. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One more comment, because I would like to go back to Representative Clark's question, and I could probably do that in 30 seconds, but the survey results from the Minneapolis home have been really, really good, and we're doing lots of really good things there. And the second part of your question, we are doing a long-range plan. We've got the request out to hire a consultant to help us with long-range planning for the Hastings campus, because that campus is probably going to be the main campus meeting to meet the needs of the younger vet, the returning vets that we're going to be seeing soon, looking at both programming and housing for that domiciliary population. So we are, that's in the works.
Representative Connolly.
Mr. Chairman, and I did see some table that came before us that listed the waiting list for all of those, the time for the waiting list for all of those. That might be something that helps to answer Representative Rukavina's question. Not exactly the concentration, but at least it shows where the demand is. I don't remember, but it was some of the material that we've had in one of these committees. Yeah. So just wanted to say maybe that could be gotten out again to people.
Maybe you could get that to the committee also. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mary Tingerthal, Commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and we're here today to talk about our proposal for the use of bonds for various types of critical housing needs in the state of Minnesota. There should be a slide presentation in your packages. And what I hope to do is give you a brief overview of what we've proposed in the bill. And then we have four representatives who have asked to speak who represent the different uses of the bonding proceeds. And we'll introduce those as they come up. First of all, since you are the Capital Investment Committee, we didn't have a chance to meet with you last year. We will spend just a couple of minutes on slide number two, giving a little bit of background on Minnesota Housing. It is an independent state agency that's been around for 40 years now, and we are, in essence, the state's financial institution for affordable housing. It is an agency that is governed by an independent board of directors, and we invest in communities for the public purposes that are set forth in our statute. We provide financing for both home ownership and rental housing for low and moderate income families, and also do a considerable amount of work trying to end long-term homelessness, which you'll hear more about. We do this, we're established as an independent agency in part because one of our tools for financing is the sale of tax-exempt bonds. And in doing those, using that tool, we are required to go to the major rating agencies every year to have our credit rating reaffirmed. And that has been recently reaffirmed at AA1 and AA+ by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. All of our work is done through public-private partnerships with partners such as housing developers, mortgage lenders, social service providers, and local governments that are responsive to the needs that are identified in the private sector. We have a strategic plan, and that has four key priorities, two of which are comprehensive. We do both new housing opportunities and preserving the opportunities that have already been constructed, and two targeted priorities, one to prevent and end long-term homelessness, and the other to mitigate the impact of the foreclosure crisis. On page three, we set forth our fairly simple request for bonding authority, which includes a total of $32 million in the governor's bill, 25 of which is for housing infrastructure bonds, which would be used to invest in three types of priorities throughout the state, and $7 million in general obligation bonds for capital investments, specifically in public housing. Why two kinds of bonds, you might ask? The state constitution does not allow for the use of general obligation bond proceeds for housing that is owned by non-governmental entities. And much of the housing that we finance, because of the way that particularly federal programs are structured, are actually owned by private individuals. This proposal is not for specific projects. We would propose, if the bonding authority is granted, that all of the funds would be awarded through a competitive process. On page four, we outline the three priorities in really four pieces that are set forth in the bill. The first is the preservation of assets. This is something that you hear a lot about on this committee, that we have a lot of good investments we've made historically in nursing homes and roads and bridges, and the same is true for affordable housing. And much of that housing is 35 and 40 years old and is at the point where it does need capital investment. The second is to stabilize communities that were impacted by the foreclosure crisis by either creating new opportunities for housing in those communities or providing community land trusts the opportunity to purchase land. And finally, providing supportive housing, that is housing with services for persons who have experienced long-term homelessness. We estimate that approximately 1,000 housing units will be constructed or rehabilitated with the total amount of the funding. On page five, I'd like to go into a little detail about how this program would work. And we do have experience with administering a similar authorization, since a similar combination of bonds were authorized in 2008. A combination of both the housing infrastructure bonds and the GO bonds. Just to give you an idea, there has been no allocation of bonding authority for housing since 2008, and all of the proceeds of those bonds either have been completed and those buildings are in service or are set for completion this year. With regard to the infrastructure bonds, that was used in the 2008 authorization only for supportive housing, and that was used for seven projects totaling 400 units, and the breakdown was three units in Greater Minnesota and four projects in the metro area, so a good distribution around the state. The general obligation bonds, which were generally somewhat smaller projects, since they were all for existing buildings, was 10 projects with almost 700 units, three of those projects in the metro area and seven in Greater Minnesota. One thing that we're often asked at the Housing Finance Agency is how funds are allocated. all of our funds, whether they come from federal resources or state resources, are allocated through an annual competitive process. We administer what's called our consolidated request for proposals, and housing developers from across the state, whether they're doing a rehab project or whether they're doing a new construction project, are aware of our scoring system. And there are four key things that we look at in deciding which of those projects will receive points and will receive the funds for the projects. The first is readiness to proceed. We think it's very important that if funds are allocated, that they are used quickly and that those assets are preserved or constructed in an efficient manner. The second is leverage of non-state resources. And as we get into the specifics of the different types, there are different leverage possibilities with the different uses, but all of those are taken into consideration. The projects must, of course, meet one of the targeted priorities that I just outlined, and they must show a demonstrated need. We require each of the developers to show us the statistics from each of the areas and show why this particular project would be needed in those areas. Included in the all of the housing must be kept affordable for a minimum of the 20-year term of the bonds. And this is relating to the infrastructure bonds. Because GO bonds are going to be used only by public housing authorities, it won't be exactly the same competitive process, but a similar parallel process will be administered. I've spoken with many of you, I'm sure that you understand that the housing infrastructure bonds are appropriation bonds and therefore included in the budgeting and the state forecast in the composition of the governor's package. This request includes a $1.85 million appropriation for the debt service. This is included in the forecast just as the general obligation bond debt service is included in the forecast, and we're working closely with the with MMB and the fiscal analysts for each of the committees to ensure that that is fully understood and that all the dollars are there as intended.
Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
And I believe you're meeting with Chair of Ways and Means this and Bill Marks possibly tomorrow.
That is correct,
and will
Mr. Chair.
And MMB.
That is correct.
And you will all agree when you leave the room, right?
That is our goal, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Finally, on page 6, we've just included some photos and renderings of the types of projects that could potentially be financed with these proceeds. And this will lead me into our speakers. The first speaker will talk about the use of bond proceeds for housing preservation, and that is Paul Sween, Managing Director of Dominium Properties.
Thank you. As Mary mentioned, I am with Dominium. We are a private developer.
State your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Paul Sween. I'm a principal with Dominium in Plymouth, Minnesota. Dominium is a company that started in 1972, and it just so happens what I'm here to talk to you today also started in 1972, and that is basically the preservation of certain project-based subsidies that are present basically throughout the entire state of Minnesota. I think on the eighth slide you have a map which shows dots, and basically these dots represent affordable housing communities throughout the state of Minnesota. The history of this program is that when it began, there was basically no place in particular for elderly people to live after they were not able to live independently. I know there was a lot of conversation about the state homes. This is a similar sort of need. You can basically drive through any small town in outstate Minnesota, and if you know what to look for, you can identify the project that was developed sometime during the 70s. Communities competed aggressively to have these built. It was a way that you know, grandma could live independently without having to live with a family member or to move 50 miles away, that they could live in their own hometown. Well, now these projects are 40 years old and they're getting worn out. And our company is lucky enough to do this type of work throughout the United States. And I was thinking as I was getting ready, I think we're involved in 20 different states doing exactly this kind of work. And what has happened is there's a wonderfully efficient system. The largest banks in the United States, the eight largest banks, are investing about $10 billion a year to help invest in this type of projects. The most efficient mortgage products ever to be in the last 40 years, interest rates as low as 3.5%. And states across the country are coming up with funds, just like Mary's proposing, that effectively add that little bit that makes these projects possible. So what you have in front of you is you have an opportunity to partner with private companies like ours through state agencies like Mary's, working with some of the most efficient underwriters in the United States. These projects have an incredibly low failure rate. They meet the objectives of their investors, who are very sophisticated and are taking advantage of some great assistance from the federal government. And so for very little dollars, Mary has indicated that for every $1, you get $5.50. I think if I were doing those numbers, the number would be even higher than that, the efficiencies of these systems right now. So effectively, what I would like to convey is that this is something that all of you have this in your community. Every one of you could have a project which could take advantage of this. The situation is like the sun, the moon, and the stars coming together right now. I think I might have mentioned interest rates for these kinds of projects can be as low as 3.5%. That's for 30-year money. That means that the gaps have never been lower. It is improbable that 2 years from now, when you meet again for a bonding meeting, that the interest rates will be that low. Never again will you have the opportunity to leverage your dollars like you have today. I think that concludes my remarks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, next we have Pat Steiger, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition.
And please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Pat Steiger, and I'm, as Commissioner Tingersoll said, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Land Trust Coalition. I'd like to thank you, Chairman House, and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk about Community Land Trust today. There are over 10 organizations providing 820 land trust homes in Minnesota. To date, there have been about 140 resales. So that means for the past 20 years, we've offered permanently affordable homeownership to roughly 1,000 homeowners. To provide a picture of these, where these homes are, there are over 200 land trust homes in Duluth and the surrounding area, over 200 in Rochester and the surrounding area, and the rest of them, over 300, are in the 7-county metro area. The land trusts go as far up as Duluth and as far south as the Wilmer area. CLTs have been an effective tool in dealing with the devastating effects of foreclosure while providing permanently affordable home ownership to our workforce. Community land trusts serve people whose incomes range between 50 and 80% of the area median income. Our homeowners are essential workers. They're tellers, teachers, construction workers, police, firefighters, and service industry personnel. The majority of our homeowners served have incomes below 60% of the area median income, and across the state, the CLT homes average is about $33,000 of income. They're effective in reaching underserved populations. In the metropolitan area, over 50% of the homeowners represent people of color, and there's a high percentage of single-headed households. Most homeowners live in the property about 5 years, which is very typical of market rate homeownership. The state's investment assists multiple families over the life of the home because it remains permanently affordable through a land lease that's secured by community land trust. One of our homeowners called it the gift that keeps on giving. That's why she was excited about being in the homes. Over the term of the bond, as it's projected, because most of our homeowners move every 5 years, the property and the investment would help four families during that time. Although CLTs have a 99-year lease, so we go on and on and on and on, so therefore we are the gift that gives forever. The majority of our homeowners, homeowners, like I said, move on to market rate, and that frees up that home to another family that's eligible for it. And typically, our research has shown that when the house is resold, they actually are sold to a homeowner with roughly the same income level. So it doesn't go from 60% all the way up to 80%. It remains very close within a percentage, targeting the population. They also have very, very low foreclosure rates. Nationally, CLTs were at 0.46% compared to 4.63% in 2010. That's a big, big difference. And that's nationally. In Minnesota, it was 0.016 compared to 1.42%. We've also been very effective in helping stabilize communities with high rates of foreclosure. When a foreclosed property is targeted, a permanent investment is made, it's no longer at risk. It's owned by a homeowner who has a stake in the community, and the land is secured by the land trust. It's no longer at risk for high turnover and other issues that may be associated with single-family rental properties. I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
Representative Scott.
Okay. Thank you for being here for your testimony. I had a question. When the home changes hands between owners, if there's work to be done, if the carpet needs to be replaced, if there's some mechanical issues, mm-hmm. who pays for that?
Ms. Seigner.
Chair Howes and Representative Scott. What has happened in the past, the land trust will bring other funds to the equation to make sure that the land trust, the home stays in the land trust and it's ready for market. And as far as I know, the money that comes to that equation is from private sources like foundations or churches or community grants, those types of things.
Representative Scott.
And the next question would be then, do you have data on the average kind of turnover costs that are invested between owners? Do you
Ms.
have any of that data?
Ms. Sager.
Chair Howell and Representative Scott, what we have, typically there aren't turnover costs. If the house is in a short sale situation or at risk of going into foreclosure, oftentimes you find these properties need a little extra help. But most often the land trust homeowner puts the house on the market just like any other market rate person, and that's the transaction, and no extra money is brought to the table.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, continue.
Thank you. okay, the rehabilitation of foreclosed properties is funded through a variety of public and private resources. Much progress was made recently by leveraging the federal NSP funds, which complemented the state's investment, and we use challenge funds whenever possible, and other private sources. But unfortunately, NSP funds are no longer available, and there are large cuts to CDBG and home funds, and we're concerned about being able to do foreclosed properties in the future at the rate that we've been able to do them now and impact our workers and the communities. These bond funds will specifically help CLTs continue the work by providing funds to purchase and secure the land on the foreclosed properties so that they can be rehabilitated and returned to homeownership and into the community. I'd like to thank you for the time hearing this bonding proposal and consideration of the larger ask that our housing advocates have put out in play, and all of those funds will assist and develop all the types of affordable housing that we need in our communities. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to help answer.
Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you. Another question. When the person's been there 5 years and they move on, what typically do they move on to?
Ms. Seigner.
Okay. Chair Howes, Representative Scott, over 80%, and this is a national study which we had one of our largest providers, First Homes, now called Windworth, participate in. Over 80% of CLT homeowners move into market rate homeownership.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next we have speaking of...
I'm sorry, Representative Clark.
Wasn't quick enough there. I just wanted to ask a question of the witness, for just a quick question in terms of... and I'm not sure, maybe the commissioner would like to go in on this too, but you did mention the increased dollars that the advocates are asking for. Mm-hmm. And I just think it might be helpful for this committee to know the actual dimension of the request in terms of the need, because it is, the need is so much bigger than what is being requested here, and I just like us all to be just aware of that. So I'm wondering if you could just simply tell us, for example, in the arena of public housing, either one of you, we heard it, I know, in the policy committee, what is the actual need for the repair of the public housing that is in every one of our districts? What would we be spending if we were doing that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, if I could possibly ask, I have one of the foremost experts on public housing about to speak, so if I could defer that question to him, I would appreciate it.
No problem.
Speaking.
Representative Scalzi.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just thought of something. Because the CLT homeowners move out after average of 5 years, what do we see in public housing? Is there a time that people move out if there's this great need so that newer people could move in and take advantage of the public housing? Is there a number that you have that would relate to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, I'm going to ask John Gutzman, who is the Executive Director of the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, for more years than I think I can count, to answer both of those questions, if that's okay.
Commissioner, we have 9.5 minutes left, just so you know that. Mr. Gutzman.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to the first question. I'm John Gutzman, Executive Director of St. Paul Public Housing Agency. Representative Clark, the answer to your question is there's an unfunded $2 billion need for capital improvements to the state's public housing. Representative, the average stay in public housing nationally is 6 years. We have 20 years of data at the St. Paul Public Housing Agency that supports that, whether it's for elderly or family housing. And Mr. Chair, my remarks will be brief so my colleague George Stone can get in. I thank you very much for your consideration of the public housing bonding effort. Nationally, public housing represents 1% of the housing supply in America. The 2000 census, there were 116 million units of housing in America of all types and 1.2 million units of public housing. St. Paul PHA owns 4,200 units of public housing. Two-thirds of our housing are for elderly and people with disabilities who earn $14,000 per year. We've been 99% occupied for 15 years in a row. Our value of our physical plant is $600 million. We have an unfunded capital need of $77 million. All across the state, and one of the handouts in my packet, which was the one clipped, is from Minnesota NARL. And there's 124 housing authorities in the state. And again, there's about a $2 billion unfunded capital needs. One thing about spending, our housing authority did receive $17 million of the Recovery Act funding for public housing. And I have a handout that shows that all $17 million went to contractors following the state competitive bidding laws. And I'm saying that because the housing authorities in this country, in this state, know how to use the capital funding, use it for deferred improvements. We made energy efficiency improvements in our high-rises, windows, lighting, toilet, boiler room replacements. We had 100% of that money spent in record time. And again, $17 million in, $17 million out. All the contractors are listed in this handout I have for you. And that same funding need exists whether it's in Virginia or Fergus Falls or South St. Paul or Moorhead. All throughout the state, our housing authorities are needing money to repair that high-rise roof or that boiler room. So there's another part of this, and that is that there are national studies that show that for every dollar spent in these capital improvements, $2.12 in related construction activity are generated, and 15 jobs are created for every $1 million spent. I'll leave my remarks there, Mr. Chair, and be happy to take any questions.
Representative Ward.
Just a little quick comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You know, when you said that there's a shortage of $2 billion. Because we hear that this legislature, you know, you hear million, you hear billion. So the ask is 32 million. The shortfall is 2 billion. And that just hit me between the eyes as I was thinking a 2 million shortfall isn't 2, but it's 2 billion, correct? So I just want to again point that out, Mr. Chair, that, you know, 2 billion shortfall versus a $32 million ask. because I didn't pick it up right away until you said it the second time, so thank you.
Representative Clark.
Very modest question, Mr. Chair. Another way to think of it is, what are the waiting lists in these areas? Because I think, again, any of us who have elders or persons with disabilities in our community are trying to get into these housing, what's the waiting list approximately?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, in St. Paul Public Housing, we have 7,600 households on the waiting list for public housing. Nationally, the statistics say for every one person housed in public housing, another four are income eligible.
In years?
Representative Clark.
In years, people wait by bedroom size, and so our three-bedroom wait, we say, is 5 to 6 years.
Representative Clark.
That's all. I just want to know, and for our elder individuals, our veterans, our older people, what are they waiting in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Laverne? What are they waiting? How many years are they waiting?
Mr. Goodman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, there's better news for the one-bedroom waiting list. So folks who are alone, typically in Minneapolis, where I work, as you know, and St. Paul, the wait for the public housing high-rises is as low as 6 months to 1 year. So there's shorter waiting lists for the elderly, longer waiting lists for family housing.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I think I saw it somewhere, and if I missed it, I apologize. But you're, for every dollar you get in, from us in bonding, and you say it secures $550 in federal funding, and then your first speaker was talking about private funding. How much private money, and what does a dollar from the bonding committee generate in federal and private investments?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, it's a slightly difficult question to answer because each of the activities has a slightly different leverage of jobs and leverage of dollars. I would say that you heard from Mr. Gutzman that in the public housing arena, these are existing units where we're doing modest rehab, and I believe you said, John, that it was $2 in direct other investment, but it also retains those buildings so that we continue to receive the federal subsidy to support the rent assistance for those units. The preservation is certainly one of the largest leverage factors. The 5.5 times of dollars retained is the rent assistance coming in. I would say that for the typical preservation project, we will probably see about 10 to 15% of the dollars will come from these bond proceeds, and the remaining 85% of the dollars will be private investment.
So,
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, knowing how you do a really good job and you try to leverage as much as you can, and maybe that's something we should see in an estimate as we, as you put your bill together, how much, like in this housing thing, what we're going to actually see come into the state, whether it's building a new building or fixing up an old one, in other dollars besides our own. And I don't want to see it because I don't want to put together anything that the chair would.
Okay, we only have less than 3 minutes left, so get the other testifier up here, and I'm sure he can talk real fast. Sorry.
Chairman Howell, members of the committee, my name is George Stone. I am the program director for the Corporation for Supportive Housing Minnesota program, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the bonding request this afternoon. As you have heard, the creation of supportive housing is one of the proposed uses for the housing infrastructure bonds. Supportive housing is a cost-effective, evidence-based practice and a proven solution to some of communities' toughest problems. It combines affordable housing with services that help people who face the most complex challenges to live with stability, autonomy, and dignity. Supportive housing addresses the needs of the most vulnerable among those experiencing homelessness. It not only greatly improves outcomes for the individuals living there, it costs essentially the same amount to keep people homeless and stuck in the revolving door of high-cost crisis interventions. In short, supportive housing helps communities move from managing homelessness to ending it. Inspired by Minnesota's plan to end long-term homelessness, our state has been making great strides towards that aspiration. In fact, today we are roughly 500 units away from the plan's production goal of 4,000 supportive housing opportunities. During the economic downturn and serious budget crisis, resources dried up and the production of supportive housing slowed. These bonds are crucial to reaching that goal. I would draw your attention quickly to a two-page information sheet that you have in your packet. Please note that these are some of the examples of supportive housing that have been constructed using bond proceeds in the previous years. Like these examples, there are a variety of worthy projects throughout Minnesota that are ready to proceed when the resources are made available. Projects such as the one sponsored by Common Bond Communities, who, in partnership with the Sands Companies, have been chosen by the Department of Veteran Affairs to develop new affordable housing for veterans experiencing homelessness. Together, they will develop 93 units. 58 of those units will include historic preservation of existing buildings at Fort Snelling's Upper Post, and 35 of those units will be new construction on the VA campus in St. Cloud. Incidentally, leveraging those properties were received for a dollar and will also likely leverage VA, HUD, federal dollars for rent subsidies called the HUD-VASH program. Homelessness is not just a metro area concern. Inside your hearing packet, you will also find a map that the agency provided showing the location of supportive housing throughout the state. Communities in greater Minnesota have seen the immediate and profound impact supportive housing has had in their communities and their efforts to end homelessness. With these new resources, more vital projects such as Gateway Gardens in Moorhead, Purpich Apartments in Hibbing, Dreamcatcher Homes in Ogama, Silver Creek Corner in Rochester, all will have opportunities to move forward. In closing, I'm asking that the legislature help Minnesota make a strong push toward the completion of the state's plan. We are close to the objective, and it's within our reach. No one wants to be homeless, and supportive housing works. Thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions that I can.
Thank you very much, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And very quickly, on page number 5 of the original one, there's a picture called Supportive Housing for Youth. And I'm wondering, what might that be, and why wouldn't a youth in trouble be in a foster home?
Mr. Stone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a variety of types of supportive housing serving a variety of populations, including unaccompanied homeless youth, families with children, individuals. In this case, often unaccompanied youth is a hard number to define. Some of these folks are aging out of foster care, so they're still considered youth by age in terms of they're not 21 or they're under 24. Some of those are squishy numbers. But that's quite often one of the groups we see. Other times, these are folks for whom being in the system has not worked, or being within their household and reunification is not possible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Members, before we adjourn, I'm just going to mention to the DFL members of the committee, I'd like to meet you sometime before noon on Monday. If you talk to Cindy, Nancy, and work that out. Okay. And then the GOP members sometime maybe Monday afternoon or right after Monday night caucus. With that, we're adjourned.